Rejected, a man of what? A man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. That kind of summarizes our world, doesn't it? The prophet said that it wasn't his own grief, it was our grief, it was our sorrows that weighs him down. Somehow the Son of God seems to be affected by what affects us. Loving something doesn't necessarily make you an expert. What I do is I get an idea for an illustration in a study like today, and I insert it into a sermon, and it makes me sound real smart. And I like sounding real smart. I love Wikipedia. It was made for me. The definition of the blues when it comes to music. The blues is the name given to both a musical form and music genre that originated in African-American communities of primarily the Deep South of the United States around the end of the 19th century. It came from spirituals, it came from work songs, field hollers, shouts and chants, call and response, simply rhymed narrative ballads. Though the use of the phrase in African-American music may be older, it's been attested to since 1912, when Hart Vaughan's Dallas Blues became the first copyrighted blues composition. In lyrics, it's often used to describe a depressed mood. The blues takes many forms. It variously is a feeling, a mood, a nameless threat, a person, a lover, a boss man, a mob, and of course, it could be the devil himself. It's often experienced as both cause and effect, action and reaction. It can be used as both hex and counterhex, poison and antidote. It can be pain. It can be relief. It can be sorrow. And it can be joy. Most importantly, the blues is both the cause of the song and the song itself. The genre was so effusive that blues became the normative term for a depressed mood amongst us all. What's the matter? I've got the blues. I've always wondered why the blues is so popular. I've always wondered why it was so popular. Although popular is a serious understatement when it comes to the impact that the blues has had on all the music that we listen to. I wonder why it's so popular because the songs themselves are so heart-wrenching and they are so painful. Why is it that we would invest in listening to something so painful for the artist and for the composer? Most of the artists and the composers themselves have lived such horrifically tragic lives, which of course is the DNA of the blues. The saying goes, you got to pay your dues if you're going to sing the blues. And we know it don't come easy. By the way, we shouldn't be too proud that the blues might be the one true American music genre seen as where it originated. Because the DNA of the blues was generated in the plantations by the slaves working them. So while it may be a truly American genre, I don't think we should be too proud of its origin. The origins of the blues are closely related to the religious music of the Afro-American community, the spirituals. By the way, the spirituals that we have in our hymnal, how many here? That's my favorite. How about you? I think the hymnal should be made up only of the spiritual. But the origins of spirituals go further than the blues, usually dating back to the middle of the 18th century when the slaves were Christianized and they began to sing and play Christian hymns, in particular those of Isaac Watts, but they did it the way they should do it. So why so popular? Because I think something happens when we hear of a true, authentic human experience. We find it popular because we find ourselves somewhere in there, a shared human experience. See, in a world where it's easy to think that we might be completely alone in our pain, a world where isolation might just be the worst pain of all, when we hear that we are not alone, when we hear that somebody empathizes with us, when we hear that someone is a man of sorrows like us, it might be the earthquake that shakes the chains. It might be the earthquake that destroys the prison walls. I was baptized when I was 26. And up until that point, I described myself, and I don't know, it just fits. I was an American pagan. I worshipped at the altar of the flag in the 4th of July. I was taught right from wrong, but that was about it. And our attempts to go to church just drove me further away from any church experience that I ever wanted. I was just fine until I met this girl. And I began to go to church to impress her. And the longer that we stayed together and the more that I went to church, when we decided that we wanted to get married and I wanted to give her a church wedding, I went to my pastor and he said that he wouldn't do it. Why? Because I wasn't baptized. I said, well, okay, I'll do that. And yes, I get asked all the time, so, did you do it for you? Or did you do it for her? Couldn't honestly tell you on that day, on that particular day when I stood in that tank. Was baptized with our daughter, by the way. Picture is she's standing in the other corner of the tank, 10 years old, about this high, big purple head haircut. I couldn't tell you if you were to ask me, honestly. But you know what? We've 41 years together now. And I was born again, and I'm still in the church, so maybe God is on his throne after.
The first real Bible studies of my life were enlightening. I loved to hear the truth taught from the Word, but there wasn't the earthquake yet. That testimony that I kept hearing in church about what it meant to be a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, I just wasn't feeling it. My first 2 years in the church was a lonely existence. I was always seeming to be on the outside looking in. And one day, I don't know what it was a youth leaders meeting or it was a board meeting, I can't remember which, but guess what happened? I heard the blues. I heard another person in the church echo the struggle that I was having when I went home, when I was sure that I was the only one. It was the earthquake I didn't realize I needed. See, what I assumed was that I was the only one in this church that had this struggle. I was the only one. And the reason was because that is the price you pay when you are the only sinner in a room full of saints. Because every time I showed up for church, nobody was having any problems. They all looked so good. They all sounded so good. Happy Sabbath. How you doing, Greg? Oh, just great. Just great. But on Sabbath, we don't have time to hear what we're really doing, do we? Have you ever asked somebody how they were doing on Sabbath and they actually began to tell you? You know, after about a minute, you're looking at your watch. I'm not going to say that my life opened up and all life's mystery opened up at that moment and I experienced true freedom and I was put on a path. But that was about it. I was put on a path. Because it wasn't until then that I could truly then imagine that God loved me. Son of God, Son of Man, Man of Sorrows, my acquaintance with joy, ours. It's a wonderful truth, but it's disappointing to know and to say that most of us are willing to leave that truth on paper. We're willing to study about it. We're willing to make a doctrine about it. But that's about where we leave it. And by its very nature, Son of God, Son of Man, Man of Sorrows, our Master Blues Man, the one who sings the blues for us, who has suffered all of that, it wasn't meant to be left on paper. His walk was supposed to be ours. His history is supposed to be our present. And our future. They came to Jericho as he and his disciples and the large crowd were leaving Jericho. Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting by the roadside. That's sad. If you know just a little bit of Hebrew, that's sad. It says Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. See, in Hebrew, Bartimaeus means son of Timaeus. If you translate it, Bartimaeus, he was the son of Timaeus. He doesn't have his own name. He's blind and he's a beggar, which means he doesn't exist in the walk, the daily walk of worshiping God. He should have his own name. It should be Greg. Bartimaeus. Greg, son of Timaeus. Alonzo, son of Eduardo. Alonzo Ben Eduardo. That's what it means. Alonzo Bar Eduardo, excuse me. But son of Timaeus doesn't have his own name. He's blind and he's a beggar. But he hears something. He hears something. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Bartimaeus knows something about this son of David that no one else does. If you lived in Jesus' neighborhood in the Galilee, you would say, wait, that's not the son of David, that's the son of Joseph. I knew him. We grew up together. We hung together. Son of David is a particular title that by Jesus' day, if you address somebody as Son of David, you are calling him something. You are calling him the Messiah. Son of God, Son of David. They know him on paper. Bartimaeus has never seen him, but he's heard. He hears something. When those who only know him on paper, they sternly order him then to what? To be quiet. And he cried out even more loudly, Son of David, have mercy on me. See, either they don't believe that Jesus is the Son of David, or, very real, they are afraid of the religious authority who certainly by this time don't believe that he is the Son of David. And they're scared of them and what may happen. So they get busy at least telling poor Bartimaeus that the Son of God certainly has no time for a blind beggar. It's obvious to us that God has already passed judgment on you. How do you think you ended up the way you ended up? You're just a human singing the blues. But you deserve where you are. But enter. See, the Son of Man stood still and said, come him here. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, get up, he's calling to you. They changed their tune real quick, didn't they? So throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and he came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, what do you want me to do for you? The blind man said to him, my teacher, let me see. Belongs to God, right? God's the creator. He has the divine power. The healing power belongs to him. But the empathy, the compassion, the mercy belongs to the Son of Man. See, and when the power of the Son of God gets joined up with the compassion of the Son of Man, guess what? People get healed. Why? He is a man of sorrow. He's well acquainted with grief and suffering. He felt Bartimaeus' pain. He had compassion. He had mercy. He sung the blues. And Bartimaeus heard it. See, what might be the oldest story in the Bible after the creation was the story of Job. Now, you talk about sorrows. You talk about suffering and pain. Job has experienced it. See, the argument as to whether or not God caused Job's problem is an empty one. We study the book of Job, and we begin to debate on whether or not God is really causing this, or did he just let it happen, or did Satan cause it? It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. That's the one question Job will not answer. Job believes that God has done it. And he's calling him out. He has a theory as to what he thinks will fix it. He thinks some sort of acquaintance with him is what he needs. But he doesn't believe God understands him. He's given God the benefit of the doubt. Yes, God is doing this to me. But the reason being is because he doesn't know what this feels like. He doesn't know what this pain and suffering and sorrow feels like. For he is not a one. Not a mortal as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no mediator between us who might lay his hand on us both. Job says the solution is the Son of Man, someone who has his hand on the throne, who understands the power of God, but also someone who has his hand on poor, broken, sorrowful humanity that would understand them. He said, if I could find that guy, if I could find that mediator, then I know He hears me. He hears me sing the word. He hears me singing my blues. Job says the solution is Jesus. Just as Bartimaeus figured out that the solution was Jesus, Son of God, Son of Man. Gospel was never designed to be learned from paper. Sorry. I'm not saying, Ray, that we wasted a year. Because we studied from paper, didn't we? Electronic paper. Not saying that at all. But the word has to come off the page sometime. Because the problem with paper is the problem with Son of Men or humans that have no compassion, that have no empathy. Paper has no blood in it. It has no mercy. It has no compassion. So the word was not meant to be just read. The word is the creator's force behind creation. It is, he speaks and things begin to happen. It comes from within. It comes from his breath. And it can make anyone understand who God really is. We know of who he is through creation, but that should only be the beginning. If you stop with nature, if you stop with God's creation, you're going to get a very incomplete picture of who God is. Amen? Because nature doesn't look too kind, doesn't look too compassionate. John and Ree, in trying to envision this for us and trying to put it in words for us, in words that we can understand, that he had to write down on paper, he said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. Amen. And then this discourse of John 1 takes you all through the written facts of creation, that he is the creator of all, that he's the light that shines in the darkness, the fact he was prophesied about by the Baptist, and the belief in him will give everyone power to become his children. And he even echoes the prophet that I read from. He even echoes Isaiah 53. And even after all this, he was not recognized by those he came to save. But apparently that's not enough. It wasn't enough for God, and it isn't enough for John, because he adds this in verse 14. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. And we've seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. The Word doesn't reach the people until they hear it in the flesh. Not until they hear the Son of Man. Not until they understand and know that he's acquainted with our sorrows and acquainted with our grief. Self-righteous themselves. They were attracted to Jesus. They were attracted to him. They wanted to be around him. Sinners wanted to be around him. We always say that Jesus ate among sinners in heaven, but we leave out the other side is that they wanted to be with him. Philippians, he asked if sinners were so attracted to Jesus, then why aren't they attracted to his church? Authentic. That's not singing the blues. I don't have any empathy there. I don't have any compassion there. In fact, I don't have any compassion for you until you realize you're wrong and you begin to think like I do. Now I've got compassion, but that ain't the blues. And it isn't true, and it isn't authentic. We know we're sinners, but we keep it from the world. We keep it from each other. Maybe they need to hear the blues. Maybe they need to hear we are well acquainted with their grief and their suffering. But no. We hide pious words on paper and studies. And yes, even PowerPoint slides and everything else. I'm as guilty as anybody. The world asks for compassion and mercy from the Son of Man, and we give them discourses and studies and doctrine. The beautiful truth that the Word became flesh, what have we done with it in 2,000 years? It's the biggest argument the church ever had, right? How about it happened? It's the nature of Christ. The biggest argument we've ever had. That the Word became flesh, it's dissected and debated until it causes fights and factions over when and where, how sinful he might have been or wasn't, what implication that has for us, up to the point to where we become actual enemies. Enemies over the one doctrinal teaching that was meant to unite us and attract fallen humanity. Pastors and theologians want them to realize that whatever synthesis we make in our theologies, it will eventually have to be manifested by the love of God and love for each other. Anything short of that is nothing but trash. I'd like to make a plug for the recovery programs as best I can. I've been in recovery for about 15 years now. They're so successful because of one fact and one fact alone, that everybody in a meeting is on a level playing field. Everybody in a meeting knows how to sing the blues and to listen to their fellow bluesmen sing the blues. They've lived the blues and they honestly sing them to other singers. There's no pretense. There's no hiding behind a paper gospel. Sin is truly acknowledged and confessed. Hi, I'm Greg. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, I'm Greg. I'm a sinner. Sing the blues for a sinner. You're singing our song. I've been asked when I teach this, I've been asked as to whether or not I'm asking whether the church is sinful enough. I've actually been asked, are you saying that the church has to become more sinful? I'm not asking whether or not we're sinful enough. I'm simply asking whether or not we're human enough. Has the Son of Man touched us? Can we sing the blues and touch the hurting world? Not to see the ears of knock. Church. We got to let him in. Can we look up from our Bible studies and our evangelistic series and look somebody right in the eye and ask them how they're doing? Rather than only caring as to whether or not they understand the point of their doctrine. One of our church's most respected vocalists, recording artist, Whitney Phipps, from no one. But you all know Whitney Phipps. He has this theory. And it's a at once horrible and at once wonderful theory. He illustrates for you on how he believes John Newton may have come up with the melody of Amazing Grace. You know, the amazing thing about Amazing Grace, the song, is that it doesn't matter who we are. People like to hear it. Atheists, everybody expects to hear it at funerals. We all like to hear it. There's something about it, isn't there? And there's something about it in the melody. And we're wondering how Newton would have come up with that. But we all know was a born-again slave trader. He was the captain of a slave ship. And in the melody of Amazing Grace, and I can't sing, but I think that there's something about it, because he, Whitley says that it has to do with chord progression and key change. In other words, it's like the spirituals. They waft and they wave and they build up, right? Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. And even the song keeps going until you get to the, well, we've been there, 10,000 years. It does this, right? Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. It does this. And then he demonstrates it for you. The reason it sounds the way it does is because it looks exactly the way it sounded. From the hell on the bottom of that ship, the tune began to loft up. No words. The sorrow's too deep for words. But the tune wafts up. See, because when those men, women, and children in the bottom of that hell, when they got acquainted with the Man of Sorrows, guess what they began to do? They began to sing. It certainly changed the way that John Newton heard them. And when Newton did it, it gave us the what? It gave us the blues. When the slave trader heard hopefully many more of the Christian men, and they heard the cries and the moans that were too deep for words, they heard the word become flesh from the bowels of the ships to the heat of the fields, they were convicted, and they began to sow the seeds of equality amongst humanity. Start it over. song because it was included on the Voyager golden record. You know, the Voyager spacecraft that was sent to explore the deepest of space. Upon it, we had a record of gold that were put a variety of samples of music from humanity, from Gregorian chants to concertos to everything else. It's a collection of drawings and teachings and music that if it's ever found by another world, they would have an idea of life on Earth. Guess what? In 2004, Voyager passed the termination shock, a spot where the influence of our sun begins to wane. And in 2013, NASA announced officially that Voyager had left the envelope that was our universe and was now in interstellar space. Carl Sagan, the head of the committee to figure out what went on that record and what didn't. Dr. Sagan says, they included dark was the night, cold was the ground, because Johnson's song concerns a situation he faced many times. A nightfall with no place to sleep. Since humans appeared on Earth, the shroud of night has yet to fall without touching a man or a woman in the same plane. We know that every man and woman were the ones who Jesus was making sure that the shroud of night would never be a permanent shroud ever again. I think the Holy Spirit intervened just a little bit to include Mr. Johnson's song on this record. Because along with Beethoven, Mozart, and Stravinsky, which is the music that's on there,